Welcome to The Message. I'm John Wells. Emily O'Brien grew up middle class in the 1990s in Westdale, which is not unusual, and ended up living in Toronto and pursuing a marketing career, which is also not unusual. What was unusual was what happened in July 2015, when Emily, then 26 years old, found herself in Pearson Airport, having just returned from a vacation in St. Lucia, being questioned by customs officers about whether she was smuggling drugs into Canada. She was. She had nearly 5 pounds of cocaine strapped underneath her dress. That moment in the airport was an end of sorts for Emily, but also a beginning. Today she's living in a halfway house and is on day parole after serving a jail sentence, but has plenty she plans to accomplish in the future and right now. And she's here with us today on the podcast. Emily, hi.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Also at our round table here is Natalie Patton. She's the Spectator reporter who tells the story of Emily's odyssey in a detailed and compelling feature that is appearing on thespec.com and in the newspaper. Natalie, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So Natalie, it's a fascinating story, this narrative you've written about what happened to Emily, the anxiety she feels on her return flight from St. Lucia, and when she's questioned by customs, and we read about her experience in jail at the Grand Valley Institution for Women in Kitchener. And there's an interesting side note to the story. You mentioned it in the piece, in that not only are you the same age as Emily, but you write that the two of you knew each other in high school. Is that right?
That is right.
What high school was that?
At Westdale.
At Westdale. Were you friends at Westdale or just knew of each other?
I would say we knew of each other and saw each other around and, you know, ended up having each other on Facebook after high school, but we didn't really hang out in a one-on-one or a small group setting.
Right. And that, the fact that you knew her from high school, is that sort of what helped lead you to the story in the first place?
Yeah, so Emily turned 30 in November, which was actually not long after my 30th birthday, and I remember scrolling through Facebook, and it came up on my newsfeed, someone was posting her birthday message or something, and then there was this link to a blog, and I saw Emily's logo, and I was like, oh, that's interesting, so I clicked on it, and I think there was one post or two posts on it at the time, and I was like, oh my goodness, you know, it was Emily sort of explaining a little bit about her story, just getting started, and it's like, how fascinating. I had no idea. I wanted to read more, but Emily was still in Grand Valley at that time, so did not have access to the internet, so, you know, there wasn't a way for me to contact her at that time, and so I was like, okay, well, this buys me some time to think about it. Is this weird for me to reach out because we did know each other in high school? Is this going to make her uncomfortable, or, you know, is this a conflict of sorts? But I had been thinking about it, and then actually when Emily got out, she reached out to me because I think she saw on LinkedIn that I worked at The Spectator and right. wanted to know if there might be a way to help her share her story. And I was very interested and said if she didn't have any problems talking to me, then I would love to speak with her, or I could set her up with someone else, and kind of went from there.
And Emily, you know, we were talking before the show that the piece is online now as we speak, kind of thing. So, you know, I was going to ask, you know, the piece, you know, talks about the sequence of events that leads to your arrest for smuggling cocaine. And I was going to say, you know, when you hear that, you're shaking your head. I mean, when you hear me say that this is your story, how does that sound to you? You know what I mean? What is it like that's part of your life story now?
Just so surreal. Like, I'm so glad it's over, but, you know, it wasn't exactly in my set of goals to smuggle cocaine through the airport to be a drug courier. So yeah, it was a huge shock, but you know, there's shock value and going up from here.
Yeah, I don't want to get into that. The shock value, that's a good phrase. So you've seen the piece online, I guess.
Yes.
How'd you feel seeing it there? Obviously, you've been interviewed by Natalie, and you know she's been working on the story and all that sort of thing. But seeing it on the computer screen, what was that like?
It was really well done. I was like really impressed with Natalie. Like, I always knew she was like smart and diligent from high school, so I trusted her to do the piece. And then the amount of time that we spent together, she's like really good with taking notes and asking so many questions that I think a lot of people might not have asked, just to make sure all the details were right. And she even managed to capture like my emotions that I was feeling at those times, and I just thought it was really well done so people can actually see what happened that led up to the whole debacle.
Yeah, I thought so too. That does capture that emotion. There's a, it sort of gets your heart racing, even though it's not you who's doing the reading. But you know, so you know, the story captures this series of events in your life. You know, this progression. You know, you develop a love of travel early on in your life, and also helping others. You volunteered with Habitat for Humanity, for example. But then you're also going through family issues. You were abusing drugs and alcohol, and you end up trusting a man you shouldn't have, who convinced you to help him smuggle cocaine. So my question, I guess, you know, when you look back on all this, do you agonize over one decision here or there that sort of put you down that road, or do you think it's more of a combination of things? You know, why you? You know, was there an inevitable progression here, or what do you think looking back on that road?
Can you rephrase that question?
I guess just, you know, a series of events in your life that sort of leads to that moment in the airport and being incarcerated. Do you look back on those series of events and think, you know, if I just hadn't done that, maybe this would turn out differently, or if I hadn't done that, or, you know, do you look at that progression that way or not?
I think it was a whole bunch of decisions that I made around one period of time.
Right.
That led to me going on this trip around this particular individual. Mm-hmm. You know, things kept falling through, you know, weird, shady things would happen with his behavior. And yet for some reason, I still trusted him and I still believed that, you know, he was a good guy and,
right.
You know, he loved me and everything like that.
Yeah. Did you know, and leading up to that, you know, there's a sense that you had some instability in your life, I guess. I mean, you know what I mean? Do you think it made you vulnerable to someone like that?
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. Perhaps if you hadn't been in that position, then maybe you would have seen through him more clearly.
Yeah. And I just love traveling, as you mentioned. And I was like, okay, you know, I'd traveled with my boyfriends before. Mm-hmm. So this wasn't unusual.
Right.
And it's not like, oh, she just wanted a free trip. But it's like, no, you're... I saw it as also spent someone that, you know, cares about you is taking you on a trip. Mm-hmm. So it was, yeah, that's kind of my rationalization for it. And you know what? It's like I made those decisions and at the end of the day, I'm here. And I'm kind of grateful. Like some of them I wouldn't take back because it wouldn't make me who I am today. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like I did have to learn the hard way, but I like learning the hard way.
Right. And it definitely was the hard way.
Yeah.
Natalie, you know, this situation, the you know, the crux of the story that, you know, a young woman ends up smuggling cocaine would strike most of us as shocking. Like, you know, I can't believe that would happen kind of thing. It's sort of beyond most people's experience. But you learned in your research for the story that it's not as rare as we might think as far as that goes.
Yeah, when I was speaking to Emily, I think for the first time we had a few different interviews for the story. She was explaining to me that during her time at Grand Valley, she saw numerous women like her, and that she did a lot of research on this while she was in prison, and that it was sometimes hard to get exact figures around it to really illustrate the situation. I encountered some of the same sort of jumping around, going to a bunch of different agencies trying to get these numbers, and I ended up being able to get some figures from the Office of the Correctional Investigator, which is basically like an ombudsperson for federally sentenced inmates. Mm-hmm. And the numbers that they provided for that snapshot in time showed that it was about 14% of women at Grand Valley and Kitchener who were serving time for importing or exporting.
Right, 14%.
14%, yeah. And I mean, to me, that was a large number.
Absolutely.
I'm no expert, but I was surprised. I mean, I already kind of knew this from what Emily said, but for me, I had no idea that this was happening before I met with Emily and then looked into these numbers and then spoke to a couple of, you know, criminal defense lawyers and a former federal prosecutor who outlined a lot of what Emily had described, not just in terms of the numbers, but also in terms of that process, that grooming, this is how it starts, this is how it ends up.
Right. The grooming is the term they use to describe preparing someone, you know, getting someone into the business, in essence.
Yeah, and I think oftentimes we hear that term connected to maybe cases more like human trafficking, but I had never heard of this being used in drug importation cases before, right. But it was interesting, the former federal prosecutor who we had an email conversation back and forth, he's now been a defense lawyer for 20 years, but he was former federal prosecutor in Brampton, uh-huh. which is the court where a lot of these cases come through as people are caught at Pearson and then they go to the Brampton courthouse. But he was saying, he said exactly in his email that, like, you know, this is like human trafficking. This is like that human trafficking grooming that happens, but instead of sex, it's drugs.
Right. Now, Emily, you know, looking back, Emily, at the, you know, all the stress that you went through this period in St. Lucia, starting to understand that this was going to be happening, that you were going to be bringing drugs back in the plane, and then on the plane, as it's described in the story, and then at the airport when you were arrested, and the court case, and then doing time in jail. What among all those experiences was the worst? Was there the worst part for you in terms of when you look back on all of those stages of this odyssey?
The worst part was like seeing my parents when they had to come bail me out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what was that like?
I like wanted to cry, but I didn't because I was still in shock, and I just knew I had so much to tell them, and it looked really bad. I knew it looked bad because it was really bad, but I didn't think it was as bad as what it really was.
Yeah.
You know, and then I was like, $50,000? What do you mean? Like,
$50,000,
like,
was the...
This is why you always got to stay close to your family, because unfortunately, you know, your Instagram followers can't just bail you out of jail.
That was the bail, $50,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I always want to be grateful for your family and keep them close, because as much as we love our social media, like, you need to keep your family close to you because they are the ultimate ones who will save you.
Right. And you were released from the prison in Kitchener on December 3rd?
Yes.
Yeah. So how long were you incarcerated for then?
Just over 10 months.
10
yes.
months, yeah.
Yeah, I went on January 16th.
Right.
And then my parole hearing was mid-November. Mm-hmm. But then I had like about a 2-week wait period because to go to the halfway house, there has to be beds available. And so someone was just leaving, so I just had to wait. And I was like, oh, it's another 2 weeks, not too bad.
And so now your day-to-day thing, you have to be back in the halfway house by evening?
Midnight.
By midnight.
Like Cinderella.
Yeah, Cinderella. How are you adjusting to that? How has that been?
I really like it, actually.
Yeah.
The stuff there is great. And, you know, before I was like so anti going to bed early. I was like, no, I do all my work at night, blah, blah, blah. But
yeah.
Now it's good because I'm in a really good schedule and I get to wind down and read. And
yeah.
It's just nice to see how other women are going through their own, you know, challenges as well. Not nice to see, but it's like it's people I can relate to and
right,
talk
right.
to.
Yeah. It's in Hamilton, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah, down to whereabouts in the city?
In Dundas.
It's in Dundas. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're being rehabilitated. I mean, this is the system,
mm-hmm.
right? Do you fear that you'll go down the wrong road again? You didn't expect to be in the situation in the first place, and mm-hmm. you fell into that. So do you fear that will happen to you? This will happen to you again? That you might relapse in some way?
No. Not a chance.
How come?
Because I went through so much pain in prison as well, like in my personal life, and I was able to go through those without using drugs and alcohol, and
right.
it hurt, it was painful, but like I knew it was a good pain because pain is a part of life. Like that's why we, you know, we love people, but these relationships end, but you know, we still embark on these new relationships even though they are going to end. They might end unless you're going to die next to that person, you know, mm-hmm. but you just have to be prepared for that because sometimes loving someone is worth it,
right.
But yeah, you know, I had a couple relationships, like someone that I was dating would like fall apart, and it was really hard for me, but stronger now, and I still care about him, but obviously, you know, you can't force someone to like love you and stay with you when you're in prison. Like I couldn't imagine what that was like for him, and I can't, you know.
This was someone you met when did you meet
him? We had been dating like for a couple years prior to that, and we'd like gone through like our ups and downs, like our breakups and stuff, but
right.
When I went in, we were like together. So.
But it didn't last through the...
No.
The,
and it was sad because,
yeah.
you know, he was still my best friend, so... But I have lots of friends now. It's okay.
Yeah. Natalie, the story you write is many things. It's certainly a cautionary tale, I think, for people, an eye-opener. But there's also a sense of redemption in the piece. Talk about that in terms of the story and including that in the story.
Well, the blog I actually first stumbled upon when I started to learn a bit about Emily's journey is Cons and Kernels, which is her business name as well as her blog. And so while she was at Grand Valley, as I write in the story, she had this brainwave where, you know, she knew she wanted to help people. She knew she wanted to get the story out. She knew she wanted to find a way to employ former inmates. And so she decided to start making kettle cooked popcorn based on what she was seeing inside, where inmates would get spices that they had access to and, you know, make their own popcorn. And so I think, you know, that is just the start really of her journey of redemption. You know, something she started working on while she was inside. She knew she wanted to go into prison with this idea of, you know, making good of it somehow. It was going to be productive for herself. She talked about how she wanted to exercise and read books and, you know, sort of reflect, but also to make something productive out of her time afterwards. So, you know, now she's been meeting with former Dragon's Den Dragon's Den folks and, you know, taking orders and doing speaking engagements and, you know, going to events and whether it's this business or something else, I'm sure, you know, she's going to keep working.
Mm-hmm. Was this something that was encouraged for you when you were in the prison in terms of starting something like this, or this was just you, or how did this even come about?
This was all me. Yeah. But then I talked to my case management team inside, like the internal, they have a group of three individuals inside the prison that kind of manages your sentence and like what you're doing and to help you get out.
Yes.
And when I was talking to my caseworker about it, they're like, I think that's great. And they advocated for me to do an event in the middle of the summer last year while I was still an inmate. So like, obviously this has to go through the warden and, you know, lots of higher ups in the institution to get approved. So they knew about it. And, mm-hmm. you know, it also makes the prison look good because, you know, I'm coming out and making changes, and, yes. and then it helps me spread the word as well to make me feel like I'm making a good impact instead of a bad one, which was what I got arrested for.
What's the name of the business again?
Cons and Kernels.
Cons and Kernels.
Popcorn so good it's criminal.
Did you come up with that name yourself?
Yeah.
It's catchy. I mean, it's a far cry from, I mean, I've interviewed some inmates at Mill Haven and so on, you know, for some serious crimes, and life in prison can be not the rehabilitation can be found wanting in a big way. You know what I mean? They're, you know, some people refer to it just more as they're just being warehoused. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They're not being rehabbed at all. But
mm-hmm.
I don't know a lot about the prison where you were at, but mm-hmm. clearly there seems to be opportunities at least for that sort of redemption piece to happen that in maybe other institutions it's not.
Yeah. You know? A lot of it was self-guided as well. Like, there was correctional programs, but it has to start with your attitude going in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? You have to want change for yourself, and you have to, like, just keep going and ask, I had a lot of outside help from my friends who would send me in articles to help me build my business.
Right.
And so, yeah, I just utilized my external resources and the internal resources as well. But you have to take charge. You have to take responsibility and be like, okay, I'm going to do this. It's going to be hard, mm-hmm. but I am going to do it.
I guess there's that, you have to have, the inmate, who's willing to undertake something like that, to have some self-motivation. But then I guess you have some support system outside as well. You're talking about friends sending you articles, and
mm-hmm.
sometimes people who are incarcerated, their support system is non-existent,
mm-hmm.
or negative,
mm-hmm.
at best, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I've interviewed inmates who they were making, you know, alcohol out of rotten fruit in garbage bags.
Brew?
Yeah, exactly. Not popcorn. Were you familiar with it? Did you see that being done at all?
I saw a couple bags of it, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, so they did.
Being carried out by correctional officers.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe, and it happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you've said in the story that it comes clear that you want to turn your whole experience into something positive, something good that could come from that, and you hope to travel. It will have to be within Canada. I'm not sure for how long that rule will be for you.
Till the end of my parole, so January 16th, 2022.
Right. And then as part of that travel, you would like to give talks perhaps to high school students or something like that.
Any groups that could benefit from my story.
What will you tell them? What will the message be that you will be passing along, you know, to groups of youth, say, if you had a chance to talk to them? What will you be trying to convey to them, do you think?
I think in this day and age, there's so many challenges that every age group can experience. So it's more about, like, overcoming adversity and knowing when to ask for help and, like, sort of how to get that help and abandoning shame and guilt. Because that's, like, a lot of the issues now. It's, like, people have this life on social media. They think it's, like, it has to be so perfect. And when really they're posting all these pristine images and it's not like that. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it would really depend on the group. I think I would cater my talk specifically to whatever group that was. But, you know, I could even talk about, like, how I got recruited through, you know, social media and, you know, how I was presenting myself on social media and just, you know, or even talking to women about the being groomed.
Right.
Things like that.
Yeah.
So it would really depend, but there's so many ways that I can take it. And I think I want to be the voice for women also inside prison to know that they can come out of what happened and do something good with it. So set an example that way as well.
Natalie, when you went into the story, you didn't know Emily. I mean, you knew of her from high school, but you didn't know her. And did anything surprise you about Emily in terms of when you got to know her through the story and telling the story and researching it? Was she what you expected to find in interviewing her and going through the layers of who she is?
Well, like you mentioned, we hadn't spoken since high school. I think we had each other on Facebook probably because Facebook really became a public thing as we were graduating high school. So,
right.
You know, a lot of the people on my Facebook are, you know, people who I haven't talked to in a long time. But so I think part of what surprised me was, you know, that section of her life in Toronto where she was starting her own business. And, you know, I had no idea that she was building this boutique social media agency. And I think a lot of probably her skills during that time are reflected in what she's doing now. Like, I mean, that her blog was so compelling and was clearly very well marketed by her, I think is reflective of those skills and, you know, a lot of those crafts that she would have honed during that time. And also, I think reflective of what she's doing now, the kind of hustle where, you know, as soon as she got out of prison, she's reaching out to people, trying to build her business, trying to get her story out to hopefully help other people.
So it sort of sounds like you've had the tools, these, you had these all along,
mm-hmm.
but you got sidetracked or you went through this rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you feel you're a different person now than you were, you know, 2-3 years ago, or not?
I still have that same drive, that same Emily energy that I've had since I was a kid, and that same positive energy that I've had as a kid. But I'm more focused, obviously sober, which makes a huge difference.
Right.
And I'm nice to everyone, but I'm also I'm more cautious, you know. I think in social media at first it was like, oh, you want to reach out to as many people as you can, but you actually have to be a little bit more careful. And also establishing boundaries, which I was pretty bad at before. And then I couldn't give my time to everyone, and then I was overwhelmed, and I had no time for myself, so I'd just be out drinking, and definitely changed, and I just feel like my brain is new, got my, you know, I feel healthier all around, like my skin's better, and my focus is better, and yeah, it's just great. I love it.
Well, it's a happy ending to the story, isn't it?
Happy process, happy ongoing story, yes, no ending yet.
That's right. Well, thanks a lot for coming in, telling your story.
Yeah.
And best of luck on the road ahead.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to life 2.0. So.
And Natalie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And for producer Aisha Nasser, I'm John Wells, and we will talk to you later.
Do a 2.0 and, like, you know,
yeah.
See the progress report.
Yeah,
well, that'd be awesome, actually.
Yeah. And then, like, the mission of my company is to, like, hopefully employ people that have criminal records. And,
oh, right.
Yeah, and I want to train them to, like, teach them how to use their record as, like, an asset instead of as a liability.
Yeah.
because so, like, you've already been punished for your crime. You know, like, why is this affecting your job? Mm-hmm. Now you can't get a job 10 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so sorry, we can't hire with records. Like, what do you mean? Like, think of all the work that person has probably done in between that.
Yeah.
That goes against the whole rehabilitation philosophy.
It's punitive. Yeah. You know, and then the person's like, okay, well, I tried, and now I'm just going to go sell drugs.
Yeah.
So it's like a cycle. Mm-hmm.